Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority, but to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. And obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors, but they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vonta comes in. Vonta is the all-in-one compliance solution, helping startups like yours get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. How? Vonta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. And the platform connects you with trusted VCSOs to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vonta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including many Y Combinator and Techstars startups, who trust Vonta. Simplify compliance and get $1,000 off at vonta.com/EU startups. That's vanta.com/EU startups.
Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups Podcast. My guest today is Bennett Barff, the co-founder and managing director of Respond, a leading European accelerator for climate tech entrepreneurs. Everyone, give it up for Bennett. Bennett, such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So Bennett, let's dive right into it. You've screened over 8,000 climate tech innovations with Respond. What's the one pitch that completely caught you off guard, for better or worse?
Oh, wow. We heard a lot of pitches come our way at Respond, I can tell you. I think the pitches that catch me off guard and the ones that are most inspiring to me are the ones that sometimes in very subtle ways are able to change the status quo in a big and meaningful way. Mm-hmm. And I can give you one example probably from our portfolio, a company that is called Resortex that is based in Belgium.
Yeah.
And Resortex developed a stitching thread that, you know, holds together your clothes and the different uh-huh. pieces of your clothes. The thing about this thread is that it will melt at a certain temperature. So mm-hmm. it's, you know, you're fine to wear it, you're fine to wash your clothes, but uh-huh. the moment you heat it up over a certain temperature, the thread will just dissolve and the different parts of your clothing, for example, they fall apart.
Yeah.
And the cool thing is that it makes it so much easier to recycle what you're wearing. If you look at the fashion industry mm-hmm. nowadays, especially in fast fashion, you'll notice that up to 30% of all the fabrics and all the clothing that is produced mm-hmm. never actually makes it into the shop because it's becoming out of fashion before it even enters right. sales. So the way that we're currently dealing with those, you know, overproduction of clothes is we're shipping it across the globe to places like China or India or Vietnam to mm-hmm. disassemble your clothing manually to take away the zippers and the buttons yeah. and everything to be able to recycle it or burn it. And with this this new material, the new stitching thread, you can actually make your clothes come apart in a very easy and very simple way and recycle them right on the spot, just mm-hmm. driving the recycling rates off, you know, unused fabrics in a massive way. This and it's awesome. Such a, if you think about it, it's such a tiny thing, the stitching thread that is holding yeah. together your clothing. You use it every day.
Yeah.
It's a tiny part of your everyday that you don't even recognize.
Yeah.
But the implications that it has for the entire industry are
yeah.
potentially massive. And I think it's these kind of, you know, ideas that take something very, very small and very, you know, very subtle and turn it into huge impact, which, you know, for me is always the moment where I get goosebumps and I'm just amazed at the potential of the founders and entrepreneurs out there.
I love it. I love it, Bennett. You know, like screening 8,000 innovations must uncover patterns. Have you noticed, you know, any recurring blind spots that climate tech founders need to address?
For sure. So there are tons of patterns. I would say something that we notice over and over again, and especially for the rather complex deep tech science-driven ventures mm-hmm. is that you realize founding teams are very much focused on product and the science behind it and sometimes not enough focus on what the market is going to look like down the road.
Yeah.
What it ends up with is putting founders in a difficult position, basically between, you know, a rock and a hard place for them to to really bring that product all the way up to scale. And that is something that, for example, when we do our selection or when we screen through the applications that we receive for our accelerator program, we pay very close attention to, is this innovation, is this product something that can find a market and really go all the way up to scale? Because ultimately, I believe that you know, the best innovations out there will only deliver their full impact potential in the very moment that we're able to give it scale and and, you know, increase the reach of the product or service. So that is definitely one thing that I see. And another thing that I notice over and over again in early stage venture is, you know, you can't overestimate the importance of very human aspects in starting a business. And what I mean with that is that I see many entrepreneurs, especially in the impact space in a wider sense, so both climate and social impact, you're not just starting a business, right? You're starting a business to solve for a problem, potentially one of the, you know, very complex, entrenched social, societal, or environmental challenges of our time.
Yeah.
So the downside of failing with your business is not just, you know, going bankrupt and starting the next venture, but you're failing on a problem that is meaningful to humanity that you were trying to solve. And that creates almost a sort of double burden on the shoulders of the entrepreneurs that in many cases I see, you know, leading into burnout, leading into stress. So that is something that I think collectively is hugely underestimated in the early stage venture game. And if you look at numbers, for example, you'll realize that founders, and especially impact founders, are much more susceptible to mental health challenges, to burnout risk, etc. And to me, this is quite the opposite of what it should be, right? We should be able to, you know, promote and support entrepreneurs taking on those challenges rather than confronting them with sort of that the double burden of what they're trying to solve.
100%. Do you guys address it in any particular way?
Well, yes, and I guess this is actually the USP of the program that we run. So let me maybe briefly just introduce Respond and what we do. Respond is an accelerator program that started about 5 years ago, meaning that by now we've worked with 50 startups that successfully went through the program. We had 5 years time to refine and iterate on our value proposition year after year. And what we arrived at is a program that is so much more than an accelerator program. What we do is that, yes, we offer everything that the entrepreneurs may need in terms of coaching on marketing and business development. And we do this in a highly individualized way. So we don't have a set curriculum, but we really try to pick up on the needs of the entrepreneurs entering the program, work with them through tailored coaching sessions to help them build their business. But actually, what has become very clear for us over the past 5 years is that our USP is not in, you know, building and scaling and accelerating the business, but it's actually working with the human beings behind a venture. And what this means is that in our program, we pay a lot of attention and dedicate a lot of time to work with entrepreneurs around leadership skills, around culture, around stress and resilience, around avoiding burnout. So you see, it takes quite a different spin at how we work with entrepreneurs and how we try to unlock the value that is hidden in those ventures and help them grow and scale. And that's particularly through working with the human beings behind the venture. Now, I think that makes us pretty unique. I guess any VC in the world will tell you that a good team with a bad idea will always beat the bad team with a good idea. So there is a huge emphasis on team, right? But at the same time, I see, especially in early stage venture, we're lacking the support mechanisms to actually help teams evolve and help teams grow and grow into strong companies with strong culture. And it's been really fun to craft this value proposition. And we have phenomenal feedback from from entrepreneurs from across the globe that have joined the program so far that this is a value add that they fail to find in any other place in the world.
Amazing. Bennett, like Respond brings, you know, not only those entrepreneurs, but also corporates and policymakers together. Which of these groups is the hardest to get aligned?
Oh my God, they're all hard. They're all hard. The truth is, I think this is so much of an ecosystem play, right? Is growing, starting and growing and scaling a meaningful business is as much a business challenge, a startup challenge, as it is an ecosystem play. With many of the entrepreneurs that are in our portfolio, I'm hearing over and over again how much time and effort it takes them to, you know, to manage basically external affairs. And it starts with fundraising, which in itself, if you think about it, is a pretty inefficient process. That involves a lot of, you know, stakeholder management, a lot of cold emails, a lot of leads, a lot of calls, etc. Many of the founders also tell me they spend so much time on building the right and relevant political networks, which for them is something that maybe doesn't matter as much in the early stages of venture, but it matters a huge deal as you progress and scale up and, you know, start asking questions about where can I build a plant? How is a country going to subsidize the plant that I'm looking to build in a particular place, etc. So the question of political buy-in or political capital becomes meaningful. And obviously, and we touched upon this earlier in terms of market dynamics and offtake, right? Who is going to buy that product or that service? So building those relationships to corporates, to customers, to the incumbents in the ecosystem is just incredibly hard. So for us, luckily, again, the Respond program is something that is operated out of the BMW Foundation. And there, while Respond is one of the things that we do, there is a whole lot of other things the BMW Foundation does, particularly in, let's say, the ecosystem piece. So we're able to bring in, you know, all those different stakeholders from policy, from corporate, from investors, and leverage those synergies across the foundation's work to help the entrepreneurs build those networks. But it's incredibly hard. And I would say all of them are hard.
So what's your secret sauce or secret ingredient to actually make, you know, those three groups team play?
Honestly, my answer would be have them build relationships over just transactional interaction. And it's so much easier to do business, to have an honest and open conversation the moment that you have a relationship, that you've established a certain level of trust within a group or between individuals. That will help so much to get any transaction out of the way. But if you start from the very transactional mindset, it's actually, in many cases, so much harder to get where you want to get. Now, I'll give you an example. Sometimes when I meet founders, and, you know, we do kinds of, you know, introductions. I'm like, hey, my name is Bennett. And then I ask the founder, so, and who are you? And they answer with a business pitch rather with their name and their personality, right? And this shows the difference between a very transactional mindset of, you know, this is the product I want to deliver. And it makes sense for founders to be in that mindset, like most of the time, because you need that. But there is also a time to switch into like an honest interest in one another, in the human being, to build relationships, because these relationships will carry you, you know, so much further, and it will also help you evolve and you know, continue through hardship when things don't go well, so much more than those purely transactional contacts that you may have. So our secret at BMW Foundation and Respond is to create environments where it's easy for individuals to meet on sort of a human eye-to-eye level and build relationships that are anchored in trust and not anchored in transactional interests in the first place.
So again, this, you know, focus on the human part of it. You know, the phrase, Bennett, the phrase planetary boundaries sounds abstract, but it's actually life or death real. How would you pitch its importance to someone who's never, you know, thought beyond profit margins?
I mean, look outside, right? So turn on the TV on any given day, and you know how important it is. So the planetary boundaries framework is something that scientists have come up a couple of years ago, and it defines 9 planetary systems, 9 planetary boundary, or let's say 9 planetary systems, and each of those systems has a boundary, and a boundary means the moment you cross it, it's going to be really, really hard, if not impossible, to come back into safe limits. And those systems are, you know, covering climate, they're covering different aspects of, let's say, plastic pollution. It's including the chemicals that we're putting in the ground and not being able to retrieve them again. So it classifies 9 different elements in which we know, driven by scientific insight, pretty well how much is too much. And what we found in our work is that the planetary boundaries framework is an incredibly helpful framework to understand what are the most critical areas of action that we need to address in order to maintain in some cases, or actually revert back into the safe limits for the economy to operate in. The notion that we can run our economy and generate growth without any limits, I think is fundamentally flawed, because we need to make sure that it happens within planetary systems, unless Elon finds a way to get us all to Mars and access the resources on Mars in any time soon, which I don't hope. I really hope that we can maintain the health and the integrity of our planet as it is.
And me too.
You know, the how would I pitch it to someone and explain why it's important? It is literally what you see in the news. It's how it's, you know, how we're creating famines and how we're creating droughts and hurricanes and floods. You know, Barcelona, not too far from your house, I'm guessing, you had pretty terrible floods just a couple of months ago. So
yes,
it's these kind of events that we see occurring more and more often, and it very easily translates back into the planetary boundaries framework and how we're transgressing some of the very critical boundaries in that system.
So you and I, we know that, but you know, people that are not so much into it, they don't. And the government still doesn't take, like, even, I wouldn't like to call it an opportunity that there is just a flood, like a terrible disaster here in Spain, and like, let's use it as an opportunity to like educate people, like, hey, this is happening because of climate change, because of like the planetary boundaries that we're talking about are being invaded. And but they don't do that. Like, they don't, like, I don't think, like, we collectively as a society, we just don't do enough to yet to, you know, fight this.
100%. I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, what I see happening is that, at least in politics in Europe, we're also playing with the, you know, the fears and the anxieties of people a lot. So the discussion right now is dominated by, you know, inflation, by economic downturn, which scares people for their living and for their livelihoods. And that obviously takes first priority in how people at large will think about their day-to-day needs and fears. And climate, in the end of the day, is something that is still pretty abstract to the state.
Crazy when you think about it.
You know, Barcelona now is one of the examples where it comes very close to home. But in many parts of the world, this is, you know, everyday reality of events like this happening. I tell you something. Earlier this year, I was traveling in the South Pacific, and I visited a couple of friends that one of them, for example, works in government in Fiji. And what he told me is that many of those small island states are today, as we speak, negotiating contracts and agreements with countries like New Zealand or Australia to take up their population, because in a couple of years, the sea level rise will just lead to the loss of entire islands, meaning there is no place for the people to live. So this is a conversation that is happening today. It's happening in a different part of the world, and it's happening to, let's say, a small and maybe underrepresented community across the globe, but it's happening. And it's, I think we need to be careful. We need to be very aware of the fact that similar things will start happening in Europe or the US as well if we don't start acting. So I couldn't agree more. I think politics need to be a lot stricter when it comes to climate. We need to find ways to integrate climate questions and social questions with economic questions in a more coherent way. And we need to educate 100%.
How do we, like, because it's happening now to like some like minority, like the conversation is happening with minority now. How do we scale this? How do we, because like, honestly, this is the biggest threat that we are facing as a humanity. So like the urgency is so big. So it's so crazy that it's actually, it doesn't have like a, it doesn't reflect in actions of people and governments, and like it doesn't come from, it has to come sort of from the top down, as like everything in this kind of cases. How do we scale it? How do we make it through this, man, crisis?
It's incredibly hard, but it's also the question that makes me get up out of bed every day and do the work that I'm doing, right? And I see, bringing it back to the entrepreneurs and the startup ecosystem, I see more and more businesses being started not out of the interest to become rich very fast, but to actually build, to use business as a lever to deliver impact and to deliver positive returns for planet and people. So I do see a mindset shift happening, especially or in particular among entrepreneurs who are seeing this opportunity of using startups for better outcomes. I do believe that there is a role to play for people like you, you know, people that have a reach and a platform to promote sustainable practices or sustainable businesses in a way to help educate and help shape the ecosystem that we operate in. In some ways, some people still believe that impact, for example, is detrimental to financial return. I think quite the opposite is true. I think in the future, we will see the most successful and the most profitable businesses being precisely the one that solve problems for planet and people. We don't need another TikTok or another Instagram. I think we're quite saturated on that end, right? But the businesses of the future will be the ones that solve real challenges. So I am optimistic. I'm optimistic for humanity. I'm also a techno-optimist. I do believe that technology will help us solve that question. But it is true that I also believe we need to start acting much, much faster. We need to face reality with a different urgency. And then trust in our abilities as human beings and as society to come out of this on a better, you know, on a better side.
100%, man. Like, hey, like I'm 100% on the same page. Like my like goal in life right now is actually to help entrepreneurs build better, happier, and more sustainable future that my daughter would be excited about living in. And it became like actually once she was born, it became even more critical and urgent for me, knowing that, you know, I mean, I like it was before as well, but when you have this kind of personal element, like even more personal, the most personal element you can imagine attached to it, then it becomes even more urgent to you, I guess. Bennett, when it comes to impact investing, what was the one big myth or misconception you think needs debunking for the field to, you know, scale effectively?
Yeah, look, I think it's what I just said. I think still some people, some investors believe that impact and focusing on impact is detrimental to returns. And I think that is that logic is fundamentally flawed.
Yes.
Again, I think the businesses of the future will be the ones solving actual needs of people. And that shift is going to happen. It's well underway. We see more and more investors being willing and keen to invest into, especially into climate tech opportunities nowadays. Mm-hmm. Now, the inflow of capital into climate tech, for example, it creates a whole different set of questions again. For example, how do we measure impact, and how do we how do we agree on standards for the impact investing economy, which is still something that is pretty new, but we'll get there. It's just a matter of, again, educating and arriving at sort of norms in the impact investing space. I think fundamentally the logic of impact versus return is wrong. I think we'll see return because of impact.
Yeah. Sounds awesome. I'm looking forward to this.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. You've guided startups across different countries. Which region you know, in your view, is setting the gold standard for integrating sustainability and innovation, and why?
Well, first of all, I would say Europe as a whole is well positioned to take leadership, especially in clean tech and climate tech. And this is something that you can see, for example, also in terms of patents that are filed within the EU on clean tech innovation. So there is a lot happening in Europe, and we do have a real chance, especially sitting between North America and Asia on the other side. I think Europe really has a chance to create its own profile and come out strong on clean and climate tech. Which, by the way, again, will be a huge opportunity also for investors and almost, I would say, a necessity for industry to stay up to date and to remain competitive. So that being said, I think Europe itself is positioned well to take that leadership position. If you start looking across Europe, you'll come across a couple of hotspots for climate and clean tech, and those are usually tied to very strong universities. Oxford, for example, or Cambridge are one. Munich, with a very, very strong technical university here and a very strong startup innovation ecosystem that is built around the university, is another example. We see a lot of high-quality talent and innovation come from the Nordics, also because of very good universities, but also it seems a very deep commitment to sustainability and impact in those countries. And we've seen a few startup ecosystems emerge that are still sort of developing their own DNA, I would say, in terms of where they land and what their focus will be. Barcelona is coming up more and more in the last few years. Lisbon has had its, you know, fair share of businesses and startups mushrooming there. So I would say there is a couple of hotspots. Universities is a great indicator for talent, and we have tons of good talent in Europe.
Yeah,
and we're actually in a good place for Europe to take the lead.
Sounds optimistic, Bennett. And I like
sounds like a red thread, right? My answers.
You know, but actually in moments, you know, when progress feels slow, because it does, what's a single piece of advice or inspiration that keeps you grounded and motivated to keep pushing boundaries, you know?
You know, boundaries will always be part of reality. You'll encounter boundaries. We encounter planetary boundaries. We encounter personal boundaries. We encounter obstacles. And it will always be part of the job and part of reality.
Yeah.
The thing that gets me going personally is to remind myself of why are we doing this? And the consequences of not taking care of the climate crisis, for example, are just unimaginable. There is no way of truly believing that it's okay not to do something about it, at least in my opinion. And I'm sure you'll feel the same with your little daughter. So
100%.
Focusing on the job that needs to be done and focusing on the impact that we're after is what gets me going. And then reminding myself that with perseverance, we'll be able to manage to come across those boundaries and obstacles. But we're in it for the right reasons, and we're pushing for it for the right reasons. That's what drives me.
Love it. Speaking of the inspiration, and things that drive you, I know that you're surfing and mountain climbing, right?
Very true.
What have these taught you about navigating, you know, the challenges of building a sustainable economy? If you can translate any experiences or learnings or inspirations from those two, you know.
I guess first and foremost, it's what both surfing and spending time in the mountains brought me is a very deep connection and a strong relationship to nature itself, right? Mm-hmm. I care about nature. I care about the state of our environment. When I'm surfing, I wish and I hope to see plenty of fish around, and I hope to see healthy corals around and pristine waters. And I hope not to find too much plastic and too much dying reef because of warming sea level rises. So there is, I would say this is the first part of my answer. It has brought me a very strong connection with nature, which also ties back into my motivation for why are we doing this work, right? Mm-hmm. It pains me to see how this planet is suffering from the consequence or from the impact that we have as humanity or with the economy on it. Mm-hmm. And secondly, you know, from surfing, there is something about a lesson that I learned over and over again in surfing, and I feel like I need to learn it again soon, is that the ocean is always stronger than you.
Yeah.
It can always outpower you in a split second.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an incredibly humbling experience for me to just surrender to a force that you know is just so much stronger than you. And there is no way of controlling it. There is no way of interfering with it. Mm-hmm. The only thing you can do is, you know, be present and try to enjoy what it offers you in a playful way. But there is no way of taking forcefully from the ocean ripping it out and doing it only for your benefit. It will always be stronger than you in that sense. So that feeling of humility, of the understanding that there are things outside of your control and larger and much, much stronger than you. And the only possible answer is to surrender and go with the flow.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has been a very powerful learning for me as well, to work with the kind of energies that are offered to you. And then lastly, I would also say patience, right? Because you can do everything to be prepared, but only the moment the ocean decides to give you that one wave, you'll be able to ride it. And that needs, you know, both dedication to be prepared and to be ready when it's time.
Mm-hmm.
But it also means you need to know when the right time comes and allow it to come to you. I would say these are the three things: a bit of humility, a bit of patience, and a very strong connection
this
to nature
amazing.
as my driver for the work that I'm doing.
Mm. What's your favorite place to surf? Or the best place you went to?
Well, I spent a good part of my life living in Portugal, in Lisbon. So I know the waves and the surf spots around Lisbon quite well. I do have family still living in Portugal. So I'm fortunate to, you know, be connected to the surf ecosystem in Portugal a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, though, that earlier this year, I mentioned it to you, I was traveling to the South Pacific and surfing in places like Samoa or surfing in places like Fiji and French Polynesia was just beauty on another level. And this has so many, and it's probably going way too far now, but this has so many reasons. Like, one of them is you can tell how surfing is not a sport.
Yeah.
But it's a deeply ingrained part of culture in those countries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Polynesians are known for navigating the waters and the oceans, and you can tell how the ocean is just taking a very strong cultural, center stage spot in their lives, and that also translates into surfing. So it comes with a whole lot more soul and so roots to the sport, which I loved. And then man, you can't imagine. It's like snorkeling and surfing at the same time because the waters are so clear that you're literally on your surfboard and you're looking down at live corals. Luckily, in many of those places, corals are still alive and healthy and doing well. And that's because these are very old corals, some of the oldest corals that we have in the world. Mm-hmm. And you have plenty of sea life, and it was not uncommon for sea turtles to pop up next to the surfers. And we saw dolphins and, you know, tuna and just that the biodiversity that is there and the intactness of the ecosystem that you could sense there was just marbling and a very beautiful moment to share there in the waters in the South Pacific.
I love it. You took me there, actually. I was just imagining being here with you. Bennett, I hope that one day, actually, it would be awesome to do that together, to surf together.
I love that. Yeah, let's do it.
Hey, Bennett, you talk about, you know, shifting to a resilient economy. If you could, I think I know the answer for that already, for that question, and maybe you already answered it more than once during this interview, but if it's an interview, I failed. But let's emphasize it further. If you could rewrite one rule in today's financial system to make it happen, what would it be?
Ooh, good one. So the financial system, now I have a few ideas coming to mind. The financial system today as it stands is narrowly focused on financial return. And I think this is the flaw in the equation. We need to start internalizing the externalities. So for a very long time, we allowed in our economic systems for the negative impact to be just disregarded and then only focused on the financial return. And I think that separation, think of how interconnected everything is nowadays in our world. How can you think that you can just externalize something and never care about it again? It's, you know, that to me just doesn't make sense. So we need to internalize some of the factors that we have externalized in the past, and this will change how we look at profit and how we look at returns. So this is one thing. Another thing is that we've taken also a very abstract approach to money. For example, if you are invested with some of your savings in shares of companies on the stock market, you're most likely going to be an absentee owner, meaning you own part of the company, but you're not engaging in the decision making of that company in any meaningful way, which creates this weird dynamic of absentee ownership, where naturally, and the same is true for me, my interest is to make a profit or make a solid return on my savings, but we're not actually looking under the hood of what is actually happening in those companies and what are the decisions that they make. And still, if we screen for ESG and sustainable investments and everything, that is all fine. But in the end of the day, we're an absent authority that is not engaged in the day-to-day business and just there to extract basically the value. I think that separation of decision making, of ownership, of financial return is also a little bit problematic because it creates too many layers where, you know, things can get lost in between.
Bennett, we're just about to start a new year, and so if you could send one message to every entrepreneur in the world working on climate solutions, what would it say?
Please don't stop. We need you. Please don't stop. We need you. You know, things will get more difficult before they get easier. So let's brace for impact. I think the next years to come will be challenging years for our economies. Will be challenging years for the climate. But we cannot stop.
Bennett, thank you so much for your time today. It's been an amazing conversation. I could go on and on. I wish you all the best, and I hope to see you soon in person.
Thank you so much. This was fun. Have a very good day.